For today's episode, I have an exciting discussion with a new friend of the show, John Brooks from the Hard to Believe podcast. We had a fantastic discussion talking about the rise of messianic cults and messianic ideology in modern society. Of course, it's a long-standing tradition of messianic cults going back thousands and thousands of years, but this is something that we're seeing more and more in the mainstream in modern society. So we talk about a little bit of the history of messianic cults, what the meaning of the Messiah is, and how this is a resurgent movement in modern culture. Do you get value out of listening to the show? If so, consider supporting us at patreon.com/thealchemicalmind, where you can join some amazing people who help make the show possible, including David, Dick, DJ, Isaac, James, Jason, Matthew, Michael, Mike and Maurice, and Sandy. If you sign up for the Patreon, you get early access to all the episodes, you get bonus content, you get access to the Living Mindfulness course, in which we learn how to be mindful, and tons more stuff. So check out the Patreon, support the show, you can get there for as little as $1 a month. Patreon.com/TheAlchemicalMind. Welcome to The Alchemical Mind. And joining me on the show today is John Brooks from the Hard to Believe podcast. John, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. I've been checking your show out. I really appreciate the way you tackle topics. So why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and about your show?
Sure. Well, where to start? I'm a religion teacher. I teach high school religious studies courses. And my show is called Hard to Believe, as you said. And the idea behind the show really is I kind of just want to explore the realm of human belief. A lot of it is about religion, but, you know, in a very kind of broad sense. I really like to sort of take apart what people believe and why, to dispel myths and also to cast light onto things that maybe are either misunderstood or poorly understood in our culture.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with the way that people believe things, and I always want to explore that. So we just finished our first season, so we're going to be starting again in the spring. It's been a fun ride so far.
Yeah, I've been enjoying it, and you do have topics that are kind of not, I mean, I guess maybe tangentially related to religion and philosophy,
right?
Like the episode you did on Lovecraft, I really enjoyed, because I'm a huge Lovecraft fan, you know,
and
for me there is a lot of crossover between Lovecraft and in particular like turn of the century horror and and a lot of the mystical beliefs that arise at the time. So it's very good.
Yeah, I mean, well, any culture's mythical storytelling, right, has a religious underpinning to it, and anybody who loves Lovecraft is also going to be interested in philosophy and religion. Like, that's not a coincidence.
Yeah.
You're not going to find someone who like loves Lovecraft and is also just like super into fantasy football. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, I'm sure there will be that person, but that won't be their like primary fields of interest. You know what I mean? So there is, I do like to find those things that that I know people who are sort of interested in the religious sphere are also going to be, you know, kind of jiving with.
Yeah, I get that. And, I've kind of been trying to go in that direction on my show recently, trying to kind of pin down, like, sort of what the ultimate nugget of a belief system is. Mm-hmm. Because I think people oftentimes tend to get bogged down by, you know, words like enlightenment or, you know, the spiritual realm or heaven and things like that. And they forget that sometimes these are really allegories to things that we can experience on a day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I appreciate that. I'm curious about your teaching gig.
Yeah.
Because you teach high school, you teach religion, and the weird thing is that when I realized that, I wanted to ask you, because my original spiritual journey began after taking a high school religion course.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So I know you've talked about this on your show, but there's something about the fact of growing up in kind of a religious household. And my dad was a minister and stuff. and getting to a place in your life where you kind of want to sort of reinvent who you are. So you kind of go away from the way that you were raised in order to create your own identity. And I'm curious if you ever experienced that with your students.
It's hard to say because, I've been teaching in a classroom setting for 10 years, and I certainly there's a real sort of wide range of students where I teach, in terms of those who are very kind of set in their sort of family Catholic tradition or whatever, or those who are just like very cynical and atheistic. I also teach, students from a variety of countries and different. So I have a lot of like Chinese and Vietnamese students as well. And so they're coming from their own sort of perspective. There's something about like the fact that within the classroom with all these sort of diverse backgrounds of religion, it takes a little bit of the intimidation factor off as
Yeah,
far as they go.
I can see that.
And I definitely have heard from a couple of students that I've had in the past who, not that they went on to like study religion or whatever, but who do cite a specific class they took with me or whatever as being really informative to the way that they went to think about their own career, and so on. But yeah, I mean, I've certainly toyed with the idea of being a college professor somewhere, and I just don't think that I want to because I really do. I'm on the same page as you. My sort of entry into this world was also in high school. I had a world religions class that I took where I was introduced to Houston Smith and that sort of thing, and Joseph Campbell, and it kind of all sort of kind of barreled from there, and so I kind of. Knowing that that was so formative for me, I feel a real passion about like giving that opportunity to at least one or two of the students that I have every year, who are going to sort of catch on to this stuff and be like, oh, this is more interesting than I thought it was.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think the thing for me was there were a couple of things, kind of, I guess synchronicities if you want to call them. But the religion teacher, it was a world religion class, and the teacher that I had was he was amazing, and I'd had him previously as a counselor in school, and so I was familiar with him. And he was kind of one of these like old school hippies, but kind of like born 10 years too late. You know what I mean? And very much looked like Alan Watts, like in his later years, right?
So did my teacher. That's really
Really?
interesting.
You don't look like Alan Watts, do you?
I don't know. I don't look like anything like Alan Watts, but yeah, my teacher in high school also had kind of an Alan Watts vibe to him.
Interesting. Maybe it's something of an era. But he was
It's
like,
got to be,
he was very friendly and personable, and kind of a rebel in some terms. I remember we had his religion class actually the period before lunch, and we were so cool with this guy that one day he asked us to go buy cigarettes for him because he couldn't leave school. So, and we would leave to go to lunch, and so we'd left and got him cigarettes and came back, and he like gave us a few as payment. But even through all that, like he was really influential for me, you know what I mean? And again, not because he looked like Alan Watts, even though, over the years I've come to know and love Alan Watts quite a bit, but just the fact that he was so friendly and personable. And in my own personal experience, it was kind of one of these things where you either have to believe this way, or there's some repercussions at the end, right? Like, if you don't believe, you go to hell kind of thing. And maybe not in those strong words, but you kind of got that feeling, right? And I think that's often the case for, I mean, particularly in the West, a lot of people that grow up in Christian households that kind of want to see if there could be something else out there.
I also I have to say that even with some of the more kind of culturally quasi-centrist like Catholic students that I have who are really in it for the peace and love and charity and all,
Yeah.
that sort of thing. Even when it's not the kind of, you know, sort of fear-based element that you sometimes see with, you know, fundamentalist Christians and that sort of thing. I do think one of the things they do still assume is there's kind of a binary, like you have to believe everything or nothing. And I think that's also one of the things that, you know, over my growth when I studied religion, when I was majored in college, and the years after that I really started to see, you know, that the nuance there. It's really not an all or nothing thing, and sure, that all or nothing thinking is one of the real obstacles, I think, to studying and appreciating various insights that you get from religion. It's nice to offer them that as well, right? Like,
right.
One of the things I really try to do is not to to lay it out, right? Like as fact, to not talk about, for instance, the Bible is like this thing that fell out of the sky and every word of it's true, but to talk about the humanity of it and the perspective of the people who are writing it, and why they were writing it and what they have to say and why that's still applicable, and to realize that, like, even if you sort of you know, pivot your view a little bit, you don't have to throw everything out just because you think, right, if I don't believe all of this in this capacity, then it's just all, right, all worthless, and I'm going to hell. Right, there's a lot of middle ground there, as you know.
Yeah, and that's actually one reason I enjoyed your show, the episodes that I listened to so far, is that you kind of take that approach with the discussion as well, right? Because I often see in a lot of similar type of podcasts, dealing with spirituality and religion and belief systems, is that you can go too far in either direction, right? So you can make it like extremely cut and dry, like these are the facts, and that's fine, right? Kind of something, yeah, you know, like hardcore history, but for religion, if you will.
Yeah.
And then you can go...
I don't have the time for that.
I don't think he does either, because he does like two episodes a year.
Yeah,
But then you can go in the total opposite direction, right? Where everything's magic and angels talk to you all the time, or, you know, right, some kind of entity or whatever. And I think it can be tough to toe some kind of balance, because a lot of times when people are actively looking for this kind of information, they already have some sort of preconceived set of beliefs that they're trying to have reinforced. And so they tend to kind of attach themselves to people that reinforce those beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I try to do that with my show. And like I said, you do that with yours. Kind of finding that middle ground, I think sometimes can lead to, you know, maybe some people kind of getting, I don't want to say angry or upset, but, you know, like they listen because they're like, oh, I really like what he's saying here. And then you get to the next topic and you're kind of saying something that counteracts what they felt you believed in the first time around, right?
Right.
And right. Yeah. And so you have to be very careful when you toe those lines.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And I mean, as a teacher, you especially have to be careful, right?
Because
you can get in trouble professionally for doing such a thing.
Yeah, and I haven't so far, which is good, and it can be hard. It's a very touchy subject. There's also a lot of it being a touchy subject, a lot of deference to it, which is really interesting. You know, whereas if you're a history teacher and you say something that is deemed objectionable or whatever, or you know, offensive, and yeah, I'm sure that happens. There's parents are more likely to complain about it than but for some reason, like, if you're teaching religion, there's this sense that, like, I have no idea if he's right or wrong because nobody knows anything about this topic, so I'm gonna hold off. So it's an I've discovered a lot about, again, the way that even people who are very religious, like, think about their own relationship to religion, just by the things that, like, have and have not happened, as being a teacher in that field. So, you know, I'm always a sponge for cultural information. So that's,
oh, for sure,
an interesting insight that I wasn't expecting to have.
Well, and I mean, you know, psychologically, it kind of makes you a better person just by the simple fact that you become more tolerant by being
Yeah.
more knowledgeable of other cultures, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
And
yeah. That's
you,
and that's that is my priority.
for
Yeah.
sure, right? Yeah, for sure, for
Yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
You see this a lot with people that, you know, that take a year and go to Europe and travel or whatever if they have that possibility. But you know, you do come back with a new perspective, right? And I didn't have that privilege, but I have lived in a couple of different countries, so I'm familiar with the concept. And I've always been curious, so it's good to kind of have a lot of perspectives and see the world maybe a little more clearly, and dive past some of the BS. 'Cause
Yeah.
man, there is so much BS right now, you know.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
In particular with well, you know, we're not going to talk about the pandemic, but you know, there's that, and you have elections going on, and all the stuff, and people really need something to hold on to and believe. And one topic that I kind of threw at you was talking a little bit about maybe the idea of the Messiah complex, and I don't know, you know, in your studies if you've come upon something similar for like a student or a disciple. Is there like a disciple complex? I'm not sure, but you know what I mean. Like
Yeah.
it feels like some people are more prone to attach themselves to this kind of ideology than others. And I'm not
Yeah.
speaking like right or left, right, or anything like that. I just mean
Yeah.
like the need to find a savior. Why that's so important. And you know, you've studied religion, so I'm curious kind of what you've come upon.
It's a really it's a fascinating topic, especially right now. And I've actually found myself in the last couple of years thinking about this a lot more. In large part because, I think a lot about our current political situation is uniquely kind of tethered to this. And I don't think I'm alone. It seems that the renewed interest in cult phenomenon and con men in general, it seems that sort of peaked in the last few years. That I know you talked in a previous show that you've watched the Heaven's Gate
Yes,
documentary on HBO,
yes.
and there's that and the NXIVM one, which is also excellent on HBO recently. And then a few years ago they did the Scientology expose,
Right.
which is also fantastic. And I think that a lot of people, myself included, have reevaluated cults as less a sort of fringe anomaly, and more like, well, wait a second, like this seems to be a much bigger phenomenon than I let on. And if you look at something like Jonestown or Heaven's Gate or Waco, even as a
Waco's
sort of a
interesting.
it very very interesting. It's and
Yes.
if you look at it as standalone things, as like freaks with crazy beliefs who ended tragically, yeah, of course, like you're just going to look at it as write it off as a weird anomaly. But if you start to see a trend, and I do think, again, I know you don't like to get political on the show, and that's fine. But I'm going to talk about this as matter-of-factly as I can.
Sure.
I do think if you look at Trump, that is sort of where people are like, well, wait a second, because there appears to be millions of people who have a completely different, perhaps distorted understanding of reality that's based entirely on what this person says.
Sure.
And a lot of them, not only do they not seem to be like the sort of people who would join cults or even recognize that they're in a cult, but it's not even religious. It's like it's this dude who's just saying things that for some reason like makes these like reaches some core of these people where they cheer and they'll do whatever he says, and if he says the sky is gray, like they're going to believe him, right? And it doesn't matter. They're just going to believe him because they've convinced themselves that he's the only truth teller. And
Right.
that is like classic messianic complex, right? That is the desire for someone to just tell you everything's going to be okay. And I do think there's something incredibly primal and incredibly human about that, that has been underexplored in both sociology, but also in, I think, the sociology of religion. That I don't think there's been enough exploration of the idea of the desire for a messiah, beyond simply the boundaries of a sort of theistic religious structure, because you start to see it everywhere when you look, right? And it tells you something about who we really are.
Well, and what I find most interesting is, you know, Nietzsche's got that whole, the famous thing, God is dead. And then Jung came back and kind of said, well, Nietzsche's not totally wrong, but he's kind of wrong. And, well, you know, the thing is, you know, Jung had a lot of mystical experiences, right?
Yeah.
And in some respects, he was kind of schizophrenic for years while he was doing his work. But out of it, he was able to escape it, right, through his methodology and create something out of it, a method for understanding the way the mind works. But during this time, I mean, he was basically a schizophrenic. And through his experiences, he realized, okay, well, you know, God's somewhere around here. So, you know, but he's not totally dead. But it feels like, even though, you know, the United States is a really odd example of the way this kind of thing develops. Because, you know, the country's founded on this very Puritan belief system, and we kind of get away from that for a while. And, you know, out of all the developed countries, the United States is still the most religious, right? And not necessarily spiritual, just the most religious. And you know, if you look at Europe, I mean, Europe is mostly secular, right? Of course, there's still churches and things like that, but the way that the society is run is mostly secular. Whereas here in the U.S., you still see a lot of kind of crossover between spirituality and politics and culture and society, et cetera. And that's kind of a weird place to be for, you know, a hyper-industrialized society. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I think that's something that we don't take into account because, you know, as we industrialize more and we get to a place where we're kind of like post-industrialization, right? And, you know, now there's talk of this fourth industrial revolution, all this stuff, and what that entails in terms of the use of technology. But how does this kind of jive with people's minds? Because oftentimes, you know, society sort of evolves much faster than our psychology does. And in many regards, our psychology is still, you know, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and here we are, you know, with helicopters and spaceships going to Mars. And I think that's definitely something that needs to be explored a little bit more. Because then you get things like Trumpism. You know, you have UFO cults that arise all the time. And, you know, Heaven's Gate was kind of one of the first ones. But there's all sorts of UFO cults nowadays that, you know, few people talk about. Unless you're like in UFO Twitter, right? And that's something to think about, just how we have to find this Messiah figure in the context that we live in, regardless of whether we are religious or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's worth going back to the origins of the word that we use now of Messiah, and understanding the sort of genesis of messianic fever of the first and second century BC, and what was happening with the Judean culture especially, but then also the sort of branching off Israelite mystic culture and so on and so forth. And what you basically had was, starting from the Babylonian exile all the way through the first century AD, was a series of really volatile times for the culture that we now call the Jews, right?
Right.
And there was a breaking point somewhere in between the Seleucid Empire and the Roman Empire, where a bunch of Jewish mystics were looking for a new Messiah, and the reasoning behind it was essentially that the religious doctrine was not jiving with the facts on the ground. And this is where I think, I'm just going to put a pin in that, because this is where I think the current American situation is relevant, right? So what you have is a group of people who are sitting around being like, well, first it's the Seleucids and then it's the Romans. And it's like, we're just always being screwed. And where is this promised greatness that you know, Abraham was promised? And I can't think of what we're doing wrong now, right? Like, the Babylonian exile was easy because they were like, oh, we've just been screwing up all this time. That's why it's happening. But it's like, what now? Like, what have we done wrong? And so the only feasible answer was this idea of apocalypticism, which was that, oh, what's happening is that this is the worst it's ever going to be. And God is setting up the pieces for a grand finale reveal, which is what apocalypse means, right? Mm-hmm. And that reveal will all center around this Messiah figure. Now the word Messiah is kind of a mundane word within the Hebrew context. It just means anointed, right? And the first Messiah that we know about, that's written about in the Bible, is Joshua.
Right.
And so Moses is appointed by God to lead the Israelites, and then on his way out, he anoints this guy Joshua, whose name is the very same as Jesus Christ, right? It's Yeshua Messiah.
Right.
100%.
Yes. Thank you.
So there's this corollary going on here. There's this sort of like weird sort of hippie, almost cult movement going on of people being like, where's the Messiah? Where's this guy who's going to usher in the end of the world? Right. And so the Messiah takes on a much bigger sort of capital T, capital M motif, right, in this period of time.
Yeah.
And that's where it takes on its sort of new modern meaning, right? The savior figure, the person who's gonna come in and be the one who, if not fixing all the problems, is gonna be the catalyst for all the problems being fixed. And since that moment, right, and there were a lot of claimers to the throne, there were a lot of claimers to the Messiah, and Jesus being one of them. Whether or not Jesus was a real person is a different conversation, but
sure.
but certainly the Jesus clubs, the pre-Christian Jesus clubs, believed that this Jesus figure, whether he was in heaven or earth or whatever, believed that this figure was the person whose death and resurrection was the catalyst for everything's going to be okay now. And what I think is really interesting is what I just said makes a lot of sense when we're talking about sort of working class middle America and Trump, right?
Yeah.
That there's this like, well, I thought the American dream, and if we just gave all the money to the rich people, and it was gonna trickle down to us, and I was gonna be able to afford a house every 5 years, or whatever, right? Like this promise of America isn't panning out, and a lot of people were sitting around being like, what did I do wrong? I played by the rules. What did I do wrong? Like, I can't figure out what I did wrong. And so in walks this guy who just breaks all the rules and says, Mexicans are rapists. And you're like, yeah, that's probably true, right? It just defies all the cultural expectations. And in a lot of ways, if you take all the peace, love, and happiness of Jesus out of the Gospels and just look at Jesus as a figure who is just breaking all of society's rules and giving a middle finger to the establishment, you see it. Like, this right. is why this is why when people are like, I don't understand why evangelicals love Trump, and I'm like, I do.
Yeah, for sure.
I completely understand. Like, of course I understand why. It totally fits into the way that they've come to understand what Christianity is, and also what their place in the world is. And he is their new Messiah, which is interesting and terrifying. And
well, and you know, the thing is, it's not even necessarily a matter of knowledge, right? You could educate people on the meaning of symbols and kind of the origin of folklore and mythology and those kind of things, in a way that would make sense. The problem is, you know, a lot of people would have issue with that kind of thing, right? And you're an educator, so obviously I'm not knocking anything about you, but one thing that I've one thing that I always felt yeah. is and I see this with my own kids, you know, having like parent-teacher conferences where kids are taught skills that are necessary for when they get into the job force, right? But oftentimes kids aren't taught just like basic life skills, mm-hmm, right? Like absolutely. How to do critical thinking. And that's kind of left to the parents. But, you know, if the parents don't have the time to educate them on that, where are they going to get their education from, right? They're going to go on YouTube, maybe join a UFO cult or, you know, some other thing, right, where they can give people those answers. And so I've always said, like, there should just be, like, I don't know where you would fit it in, right? Because it couldn't just be like a unit in a sociology class. It would have to be like a recurring thing where you're taught basic life skills and not just like a cooking class,
Yeah, right,
right?
exactly.
But like how to do critical thinking.
Humanities.
Yeah. I mean, where would you fit? Well, you can't fit into humanities. And look, I was an English major. They fit everything into humanities. So you couldn't really do it there, right? And you couldn't do like a counseling class because people would, there's a stigma. Why am I going to a counseling class? So that's kind of an issue. But I've always felt like we need to have some of this education in school, right? And just to make people like proper people. Right? So people don't feel so lost, especially nowadays when like everybody's truth is so different from everybody else's that nobody knows what to believe in anymore. So they just go and believe the craziest things and
Yeah,
find no proof for it.
I completely agree with you. I would say like I know a lot of people, and I'm guilty of this myself sometimes, get, very angry at fascism, right? But here's the thing. I like my primary my first response is actually, first of all, it's pity, but second of all, it's anger, not at them, but rather at the system that made them. That this doesn't work. Look at any populist fascist over time, or any person deemed a messiah over time, whether that's Mussolini or Hitler or Hugo Chavez or like whatever,
Sure.
right? Any cult of personality leader, and pick a time in history, the first requirement is to rob people of the ability to think critically, to take away their access to critical information. I worked at Fox for a while, and so I can I know like I know how the machine works, right? Like I've seen the inside working of the media machine, and I know for a fact that like these people who believe this stuff, right? Not only do they believe it because, again, like they're looking for a messiah to tell them it's all going to be okay, but they also believe it because we have given them a culture. We have robbed them of a education system that was designed to make people into factory workers in the
Right.
Industrial Revolution. We haven't updated it, and so we've created a system whereby facts are optional, whereby you can put someone on television who says, on one side of the screen, here's a scientist who will tell you the signs of global warming, and here's another scientist who says it's not true, and create this system whereby like any fact can be countered with another fact, or just an opinion stated as fact, where you have this system where people cannot think critically because we have been robbing the education system of money for the last 100 years. And are we like this was engineered. Right,
Correct.
all of those people, like all of those MAGA hat people, again, like ultimately I don't blame them. I do to some degree, but like I'm more angry at a country that has divested from its investment in the greater good and in public well-being for a century. And that's what makes me furious, right? And that's what makes me scared, and makes this sort of phenomenon, again, when I look at it in terms of the history of religions and cults, really, really freaks me out, right? And that's why I am alone among my friends, I've been trying to tell them all about QAnon and why they should care about it,
For
right? Because
sure.
I'm like, this matters more than you think it does,
For sure.
and it sounds crazy, but like you need to take it seriously.
No, I agree. And I don't agree with a lot of things that Jordan Peterson believes in, for example.
Yeah, me either.
But he's got a really great line in that you have to have a left and a right, right? Because you
Absolutely.
have one side that does the critical thinking, and then you have the other side that gets the work done. And
Right.
you can't like you can't dissimulate these two sides, right? And for me, like that's a very Taoist idea, for example. And I love Eastern philosophies in particular. And In Taoist philosophy, you have this idea of, you can't have the black without the white, or the light without the darkness, and things like that. And this is how it works. This is what I'm saying. Like, it's all common sense, right? It might be veiled in metaphor and beautiful imagery and airy fairy stuff and supernatural entities sometimes. But ultimately, a lot of these things at their core, at the mystical core, really are just truths about how to be a normal person, how to be a human being, right? And that's to care for each other and to listen to other people's opinions, not get angry, have actual discussions, and learn to work together. And you're right. The fact that our educational system has been so terrible for so long and so disregarded, is insane. And that's the reason why we get to the place where we're in. And what worries me is not so much the fact that these ideologies arise, because they always arise, right? That's inherently in human nature. But the fact that they're getting to a place where it's becoming dangerous for society as a whole, right? And I think that's what's most important. And we're not fixing it, right? So they were about to pass this COVID bill, for example, and there's hundreds of billions of dollars going overseas. Well, why, right? It's a COVID bill for people to get paychecks and whatever other stuff. There's $100 million in there for furniture for the Senate. Like, why, right? That's not a COVID bill. There's I think there was like $10 billion for Tibet and like a clause for recognizing the Dalai Lama as like the head of Buddhism. Like, why?
Well, that's good.
I mean, yes, of course it's great, but that's not a COVID bill, right? That's not what you're signing up to do. And you see this kind of spread throughout. And I don't agree with Trumpists, but they do have a point in this regard, right? Where we're so focused on everybody else that internally we're just falling apart. And so people try to gravitate to that messiah that will help them from falling apart. My only concern is when it's kind of dangerous.
No, I completely agree. So what I would also say is that the ability to have those critical thinking skills, and frankly to have the time to develop them, because the other thing that we don't talk about enough is that a lot of these people work, four or five of the jobs that Trump
Yeah,
created to
sure.
get by. And so they don't have time to read books. They don't have time to you know what I mean? Like this is, they are literally working their asses off just to get by. And they might have time to go to a Trump rally. And that's like the one thing they do every, you know what I mean? So if we're not prioritizing people, developing as human beings, then of course this is the world we're going to wind up with. And to not be able to, when you say we're sending this money to this country and why, right? I do think there is national self-interest reasons to send money to other countries sometimes,
100%.
but we need to be able to explain why, and to live in a world where like that makes sense, right? Where the idea of caring about American citizens first also involves doing certain things in other countries, right?
Yes.
Within reason, namely of a humanitarian bent, not a militaristic one.
Sure.
But to me, like, it all sort of starts with compassion, right? And again, like, I have a lot of my friends are, we're all sort of the same political persuasion, and we all think the same stuff about
Naturally.
Trumpism. And yeah, and I know that intellectually they also are able to understand that in a lot of ways, like these people are also victims of the system, but lose sight of that, and understandably, because it's incredibly frustrating, and you want to vent. But the thing is, right, in a similar vein, I look at the dead bodies in the Heaven's Gate cult, like lying under those tarps, right, with the sneakers sticking out, and I think the same thing. I'm not angry that you believe something that's clearly nonsensical. I'm angry that we have allowed this to happen, and that the DNA of the Heaven's Gate cult, if you look at where it came from, if you look at the time period, like what was popular at the time, and the sort of like, you know, premillennialism and ancient aliens phenomenon sort of merging into one thing, like it made a lot of sense mm-hmm. to a lot of people, because that really was their worldview. And it makes me sad and angry at the same time. But also, you know, I need to remind all of my liberal friends that, but for the grace of God, you know, that only a few things had to change in your life to put you in one of those rallies, like mm-hmm. to put you in a MAGA hat. It wouldn't take very much. And at the end of the day, you know, you need to recognize like what those things are and how maybe you can offer them to others. And when I talk about Scientology to my students, for instance, and I love talking about Scientology to my students because I'm obsessed with Scientology. One of the things I say to them, like is in a lot of my classes, is if you remember nothing else about this class, if you remember nothing else I ever taught you, right? Remember this. If you're walking down the street and someone offers you a free stress test, turn and run the other way as fast uh-huh. as you can, right? Uh-huh. Like that, because you will fall for it, because everybody does, right? Like it's not, you're not as smart as you think you are. And you know, the we'd like to think that we're able to overcome our emotional vulnerabilities through our intellect, but we're not. And that's reality.
Yeah, that's funny that you mentioned the stress test, because it reminded me of my run-ins with the Hare Krishnas in New York.
Yes.
You know, they always have like a young guy, right? Looks very innocent, mm-hmm. and he's just got books, right? And he looks kind of somewhat recognizably as maybe a Buddhist monk of sorts. Or a similar tradition, and you're like, yeah, the Buddhists are like super peaceful and great, and let me see what this guy's got to say. But that's always the tactic, right? If you go back, I mean, really throughout the history of modern cults, but you really start seeing this ramping up in the 50s and 60s, that's always the entry point into the cult, right? It's like, oh, you need to learn to quit smoking. Who was it that did that? The Ann Hill Kids in Canada. Mm-hmm. They started as like a quit smoking like 12-step program from the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Right.
And so that was the way in, right? You want to quit smoking? Come take our seminar. And then, you know, people start coming in and the guy already has this sort of messiah complex to begin with, kind of a, you know, very narcissistic. And naturally he begins to turn this into something else. And obviously takes it very far away from where it started, even from Seventh-day Adventist beliefs. And, you know, the Seventh-day Adventists are kind of a discussion on their own anyway.
Absolutely.
But, they're very interesting, right?
They are.
I would say a lot of similar movements, right? Like the Pentecostals, for example, are really interesting. And that's kind of where you get figures like Jim Jones coming out of Pentecostal traditions.
Right.
Yeah, that's always the entryway. And you see that in the Heaven's Gate cult too, right? It's like, hey, let's do this seminar for, you know, 20 people so they can ask us about aliens. Because, yeah. I mean, everyone wants to hear about aliens, right? Whether you believe in them or not, you're like, yeah, this could be cool. You know, whatever, a few minutes.
Yeah.
And there you go. And you know, one thing I really liked about the documentary that you don't see in a lot of other similar documentaries talking about cults is the personal aspect that was in there. And it's so obvious that like all these people were super smart, right? Like these weren't educated, like lower class, like coal miner type people, right? They were mostly college educated. I mean, yes, there were some kids that, you know, they joined as kids. But a lot of these people were college educated. They had careers. And mm-hmm. and so it's not a matter of being smart or well educated. It goes much deeper than that.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where you need to really understand how much of what you think is the result of sort of your just absorption of culture around you, right? And I think one of the ways that, again, when you look at the Heaven's Gate cult, like now, because when that all sort of came to a head was the mid-90s, mm-hmm. and at that point, right, UFOs were all just like X-Files. Like it was like the 90s were super into UFOs, but as a sort of like cool fringe, you know, Albert Bell, Coast to Coast Radio, yeah. right? Sort of like, but it wasn't like a religion culty thing. And so people were like, oh, that's weird. They all believed UFOs were going to take them up into space and they killed themselves for it. But it's like, well, yeah, but this thing didn't start in the 90s, right? It started at a time when, you know, the hippie movement had kind of fizzled out, that there was a lot of pessimism. And like, there was a growing interest in UFOs, and like a lot of the Roswell stuff was made sort of public at that point. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, oh, so, you know, we're in this weird technological place, and like, maybe there's aliens, and like, also Christian apocalypticism had resurged, because a lot of the hippies became fundamentalist Christians. And
yeah,
it's like,
it's crazy.
You put that in a blender and yeah. you're like, oh, of course this makes sense to people, because this is just the next phase of what their sort of cultural experience has been, right?
Right.
Coming into fruition. And, you know, I think that's a really important thing to understand. Again, it's one of those things where it's like, with my friends, again, talking about Trump, I'm like, yeah, but look, and I'm not excusing their behavior. And like, yes, when someone is explicitly racist and carrying like, you know, a Nazi flag and like you're on their team, you should think about what you're doing, right? But at the same time, you do have to understand the reason why there's so much loyalty to this guy, and that it's not really about him, and it's not really about politics, and right. it's not really about policy, right? It's there's something far more, right, like primal and urgent about it. And you know, that's a really, it's a hard thing to articulate to people. But you know, I think people, well, like ourselves, who are like interested in this sort of sphere, I do think it's incumbent upon us to have those conversations.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the one thing that I always say to people on either side is, you know, don't just completely disregard the other opinion, right?
Yeah.
And you see this a lot, particularly in the mainstream. You know, YouTube is constantly banning people nowadays, for example. And I'm not saying that what they're saying is correct. And I hate the argument of First Amendment rights, right? Because
right,
like you can
right,
take
yes.
that really far, right?
Yeah.
But there is a very thin line that you can toe, and I think, again, maybe it goes back to this idea of just teaching basic skills on how to be a normal thinking person, right? To allow yourself to feel and allow yourself to think. But you know, if you start deplatforming people and kicking them off of social media and, you know, whatever else, they just go and create their own platforms, right? Because the technology is already available now, anybody can do it. And the problem you create there is echo chambers, right? Because now the people on one side feel like, okay, well, this person's not on YouTube anymore, like the world's a better place, right? Now my kids can watch YouTube again. And meanwhile, you have like no tube over here on this side, right? Where it's just everybody that has alternative beliefs to the mainstream. And that's very, very dangerous, because that's really when you can get into hardcore fundamentalist cult mentality, because there's nothing to resound off of, right? Everybody right. in your circle believes exactly what you believe in. And right. and again, this is not like bad or wrong, right? You know, you mentioned your circle of friends have similar ideas and belief systems. Of course, like that's the way it works, right? If you don't like somebody, you're not going to be friends with them. But they're in a society, in a civil society, we have to be able to balance these two things out. And I don't think deplatforming and banning anybody is the correct option. What the correct option is, I don't know. Because if I did, I would announce to the world and be a multi-billionaire, right? Because nobody has figured it out. But I think we always have to kind of keep that in mind, right? Again, I'm very Eastern influenced, so I'm always about, you know, finding the center and kind of working between the yin and yang. But, you know, that's – most people don't have time to think about those kind of things, right? They're just trying yeah. to earn a paycheck.
Yeah. And we make it very hard for their paycheck to go anywhere. And so that's part of the problem, right?
Yeah.
I do think like one of the things that I love about your show is, you know, and as I've listened to a whole bunch of back episodes is I think you and I both kind of, you know, come from the perspective that every problem is the same problem, and
Yes.
like, right? And so you can then explore any of those threads, and you will discover, right, the whole tapestry. And you know, to get back to sort of where we started here, that's ultimately like why I decided to study religion. I'm not personally all that religious, and like I almost don't even have time to be religious because I'm so busy, right, like teaching and learning about the history of religion that doing the religion part of it is almost like I can't fit that in.
Sure.
But you know, to me, like there's a couple of things that sort of triggered, right, that exploration, and one of them was, you know, I grew up in an Episcopalian family, and you know, we went to church on Sundays, whatever, until the kids decided we didn't want to do it anymore, and it was very typical, like 1980s, right, religious upbringing, and I do remember like this one time being in church and being incredibly bored, and then being like, but if God made me and I'm bored in church, then didn't God make me like to be bored in church? And that
Right.
seems weird and contradictory. And like that one little like nugget, I followed that for years. I needed to answer that question, right? I needed to understand, like, why do people believe in this God character? And like, do we have any evidence for it? And like, maybe we do, maybe we don't. And I realized that that's how I connect with people, is that's what I find most interesting about them, is their degree of religiosity or lack thereof, and how they express, right, that their sort of core self, which again is kind of what I try to get at in my podcast, and the people that I want to talk to, and so on. Anyway, I need to tell you this story very quickly,
Okay.
because you mentioned the Hare Krishnas earlier.
Yes.
So you know, I went through again. I read Houston Smith in high school, and then I had a professor in college who I took a bunch of classes with, who also had a big sort of Alan Watts vibe, and you know, a sort of hippie dude with a white sort of salt and pepper beard and so forth. And anyway, and he was big into Buddhism, and I took a bunch of Buddhist classes with him. So I was studying a lot of Hinduism between high school and college, and in college as well. And you know, I knew enough about sort of the Hare Krishna movement and cults in general, that I could approach a Hare Krishna without succumbing, right? Like
Yes, yes, yes.
so I saw one in an airport who is exactly as you describe, right? The sort of people they put out there to like give out the literature. But the coolest thing is that I was able to walk away from that with a free copy of an interactive Bhagavad Gita CD-ROM, which was just like the greatest.
That's impressive.
It was super cool. And I was like, I'm not going to join your cult because I know, like, I already know. So, like, you're not going to get me. But, like, I'm very appreciative of your Bhagavad Gita CD-ROM. Yeah, that was the coolest thing. But yeah, you know, the other one was I worked in Manhattan for a long time, and I used to transfer at rush hour every morning at the Times Square, right, subway stop. Which, if anybody doesn't know, New York is the most stressful place on earth at
It
the most
is.
stressful time
Yes.
on earth, right? And that's where the Scientologists camp. And that's where they have their little table where they offer free stress tests. And I was always like, I'm kind of tempted just to like see if I can outsmart them, right? Like, I'm kind of tempted to say yes and just see if I can like, but I was like, I know, like I'm not gonna give in. Like I can't test my own ability to stay away from Scientology. But I always admired their moxie, right? I'm like, that's good. If you're gonna offer free stress tests, that's the place and time to do it.
For
Like
sure.
7:30 a.m. on a Tuesday in Times Square, transferring between the one, you know, the 19 and the NQR. Like that's where you go. So good on you. So, very sophisticated cult. They are fine-tuned that thing to a heck of an instrument. But anyway,
They certainly have. You know,
yeah.
we should do an episode. Are you planning on doing an episode of Scientology for your show?
I actually did one. I interviewed. I'm going to do another one.
Did you? How did I miss that?
Yeah. I interviewed Tony Ortega, who has been covering Scientology for decades. He used to write for the Village Voice. But he was one of the first to really sort of jump on the "this is something worth writing about and exposing" bandwagon. And so he's been a thorn in their side for decades, and he has a website called The Underground Bunker where he just exposes Scientology all the time, and they constantly are after him, and is a really interesting guy. But he's the one who actually effectively brought down Danny Masterson. So he kind of exposed the way that Scientology had covered up the various rape accusations against Masterson. And so that sort of put him really heavily on their radar in the last couple of years.
Interesting.
But yeah, he's an interesting guy. So that was, I think, probably my fifth or sixth episode. It's pretty early on.
I'm looking at it now. I'm not there yet because I just I got up to the Cathars episode. Because, Gnosticism holds a special place in my heart. Growing up as a Christian and then being introduced to Eastern philosophy, the two meshed into a thing that really feels a lot like Gnosticism to me. Yeah. So I appreciated that episode. So yeah, it's cool. Like right a few episodes past that, and then I listened to the latest couple ones, the Christmas one. I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I did too. That was fun.
I love those things. We're recording this before Christmas, but I did an episode on Christmas because one thing that I notice around this time of year is that everyone starts talking about like the pagan origins of Christmas. Mm-hmm. And that is true. There are pagan origins to a lot of the rituals.
Yeah.
But Christmas itself is like a very Christian tradition, right? And so I wanted to do something kind of towing the line between the two. I talked a little bit about Pope Julius and all that stuff. So that was fun. Yeah. I enjoyed that one.
Yeah. It's one of the least important Christian holidays, right?
100%.
Right. Because it really was essentially added to the calendar. It's like who sucks? The Gnostics, right? Jesus was born and therefore a human. So let's celebrate that. But yeah, right. I think what people get confused about is they have the sense that everything that we do at Christmas existed in Saturnalia and right. Juvenalia the festival of Sol Invictus and Yule and all that sort of thing. It's like, well, not exactly, right? Like all that the midwinter festival existed. Christianity was like, we should do that too. Let's add our own thing. Like we'll place a holiday there. We'll have our own rituals, and it's part of a great melting pot that is this sort of fantastic cultural invention, right? That ended up being Christmas. But no, I completely agree with you, and I think that that's the idea. The narrative that every Christian holiday is just like some stampeding herd that is destroying a pre-existing pagan holiday and replacing it with Jesus is wrong.
It's wrong, correct.
But let's have that conversation because there's a lot more to it than just, oh, we decided that December 25th was going to be a day that we celebrate. And it's like, did ya? Because, seems like a lot of people have been celebrating stuff and like giving each other presents and eating tons of food and getting wasted over this time of year for a long time.
That's
so
true.
So,
well, the thing is, belief systems evolve, so quickly and all the time. And human lifespans are so short, right? So even something from 100 years ago, you'd have no idea. I remember you guys, I think it might have been on your first episode, actually, were kind of briefly talking about fundamentalism. Yeah. This whole idea of taking the Bible literally as, everything being 100% true to the word is so recent, right?
Yeah.
Within 150 years, and then like really cemented after the what was the evolution, the monkey scopes trial,
right?
That's yes. Like when it really became cemented, because yes. You had a lot of this revivalist movement going around, and they became very fundamentalist, and through that push, kind of got what became, like televangelists, for example. But this very literal interpretation of things. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny, sort of getting back to again where we started here is that a lot of that, like the fundamentalist drive, whether it's in Islam or Judaism or Christianity or wherever it is still also kind of part of that messianic drive. It's that idea of I just want someone to tell me it's all going to be okay, and if I just believe that every word of this is true and every piece of counterfactual evidence is not, I feel better because like I don't ever have to worry about anything coming in and destroying this little bubble I've created. And in a lot of ways, like fundamentalism is turning the Bible into the Messiah, right? And like it's that same instinct, it's that same impulse, except you're just doing it for this book, right? And wrapping yourself up in it and clinging to it and never letting go.
Yeah, I did this series on epistemology kind of concurrent with the episodes I did on Gnosticism. And one thing that's in there is kind of the really interesting psychology of this looking to a savior. We're gonna coin the word, okay? We're gonna call it disciple complex. I've already decided.
I
And
like
trademark John
it.
and I 2020. Okay. So but the psychology behind it, right? Because people don't want to feel responsible for their crappy lot in life, right? And so if you find a savior and it doesn't go right? Like Jesus never comes, or the aliens never come and take you, or you send them a $5,000 check and you don't win the lottery the next day. If that goes wrong, it's not your fault. It's this person's fault, right? Until they learn how to play around with that, and this is especially true for things like televangelists, where they, all right, send me your $2,000 check, and whatever, your grandma will be healed. You send a $2,000 check, grandma's not healed, and you say, well, preacher, grandma's not healed. I sent you this money, and the preacher says, well, it's because you didn't believe hard enough. So now you got to send $5,000, right? And so ultimately, like you're stuck in this psychology of what if, what if, what if, just because you don't want to feel bad about yourself. And that's why I like things like Buddhism, right? Because they, listen, there's a lot of dogma in that as well, right? Yeah, for sure, 100%. And I'm not talking about Hare Krishnas or anything like that. But just within traditional Buddhism, there's a lot of dogma. And it's funny because, like Buddha says, like same thing that Jesus said, right? Like I'm not like somebody special. Like I'm here to just teach you, right? You and I are the same. And but there is dogma. But one thing that's kind of inherent to that is the understanding of the way the mind works, right? Again, in a more mystical kind of allegorical, metaphorical sense. But a lot of people talk about Buddhism being kind of a very early way of doing psychology, right? And that is very true. You just kind of have to get past the literal interpretation, and see what's at the core of the message. That's probably why I love Jung so much, to be honest with you. But yeah. All right, you want to wrap it up?
Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, it's been great, man. I appreciate it. So John can be found again at the Hard to Believe podcast, a podcast about belief. Wait, on the Cage Network, is that right?
Cage Club Network.
Cage Club Network. Man, listen, I listened to your first episode, and I was like, why is it called the Cage Club Network? And then you guys went into it, and I was laughing hysterically.
It's a thing that sort of spiraled out of control with a very bad idea that turned into an amazingly long podcast about Nicolas Cage. And then spawned a bunch of other things. I'm on Spotify and Stitcher and iTunes and all those things. Just search Hard to Believe. I'm on Twitter at probably Real JB. And you can check out all of season one on my own website, which is hardtobelieve.me. And there's a little tab there for season one, and you can just listen to whatever you want. And we'll be back in probably March or April sometime. So.
Very cool. I want to thank John again for joining me in the show. It was a treat having this kind of discussion. Not something that I usually do on the show, but I felt it was worth talking about. If you want to get in touch with me, of course, you can find me on Twitter, @MindAlchemical. You can email the show, Martin@TheAlchemicalMind. And, of course, check out the website for the links to all the great things, including the Discord, the Patreon, and more. I want to thank you all for listening, and a happy 2021, as this is our first episode of the year. As always, remember that you are it.